Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, John Dennis here with News Desk from Guardian Unlimited on Wednesday, February the 14th. Today, children growing up in the United Kingdom are more deprived, they have worse relationships with their parents, and they're at greater risk than those in any other rich country, so says UNICEF. British drug firms accused of paying bribes to the regime of Saddam Hussein under the discredited Oil for Food programme are being investigated by the Serious Fraud Office. 10 Downing Street is considering how it will respond to a petition on its own website that's now been signed by 2 million road protesters. Also today, what's going on at London Fashion Week? Not just the furore over size zero models. And why a new film based on the life of one of France's most beloved stars has unleashed a wave of nostalgia. Regretting nothing, John Henley's going to be telling us what's in the Guardian diary, and Mark Oliver's here with the papers. Where's the best place in the world to bring up children? It's the Netherlands. A league table of the world's wealthiest countries has been put together by UNICEF, that's the United Nations Children's Fund. Out of 21 countries, Britain's the worst. Children are poorer, at greater risk, and more insecure as well. The United States came second to bottom. Sarah Bosley's the Guardian's health editor.
UNICEF took three different dimensions, as they call it, three different areas of children's life, and looked to see whether they could measure their well-being in each one of those. Those six areas were material well-being, so there you're talking about whether a child's living in poverty or not, health and safety, educational well-being, family and peer relationships, and behaviours and risks. And there they're talking about whether they drink alcohol or they use drugs or engage in risky sex, and also young people's own perceptions of their well-being. And what they did for 21 countries, so this is a formidable exercise, was draw together the research that's been done in each of those areas where they could actually compare the data. Obviously, that's not an easy task to do, and there will be arguments that this isn't as precise and accurate as all that, but it does give you a general picture in that the data is probably similarly not perfect from all of those countries.
And Britain came out worse than 20 other advanced nations.
Yes, this is the most extraordinary thing. 21 wealthy nations, all of Europe, and Britain was 21st. We were trailing the USA by not very much. Right up the top there you had countries like the Netherlands and Finland, countries where they do positively make a lot of effort to look after children in perhaps ways that maybe we don't. But these things, the sort of measures they're looking at are how children actually feel about their own lives and how they relate to their friends, whether their friends are kind to them, and also how much time they spend with families, all sorts of things that maybe we don't look at as carefully here as perhaps people do in other countries.
Why do you think that is?
This is the difficult question. There are some extraordinary remarks from Al Ainsley Green, who's the Children's Commissioner, and he's talking about a crisis at the heart of our society and saying we must not continue to ignore the impact of our attitudes towards children and young people and the effect that this has on their well-being. We talk down to them, or we ignore their feelings, or just simply don't talk about drawing them in as important people.
Tony Blair's government has made tackling child poverty a priority. Do today's findings mean that all that investment by Gordon Brown has been wasted?
No, I definitely don't think that's the case. They say they're making progress. I'm quite willing to believe that they are. These things take a very long time to turn around.
It is striking that the countries at the top of the league, where it's great places to bring children up, the Netherlands, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, all countries with much more equal distribution of wealth. What role does inequality have in the well-being of children?
I think that's quite a significant part of all of this. Now, child poverty is a relative measure again. You know, the fact that a child is poor in Czechoslovakia and poor in our country doesn't mean to say that their family have got equal amounts of money. The Czechoslovakian family is obviously going to have less money because we're talking about relative poverty, so those people who are at the bottom end. But what you're talking about with the bottom end is, again, social exclusion, people who haven't got as much, who are left out, and who are not looked after in the way that the best off are.
Now, Mark Oliver's here. He's had a good look at today's papers for us. Mark, what do the papers make of the deal that was announced yesterday by North Korea that it's going to start disarming its nuclear capability?
Well, there's some quite meaty analysis in the Financial Times where it is questioning whether or not North Korea is ready to come back into the fold in the international community or not. Of course, the FT says North Korea has agreed to things in the past and then reneged on it. But because of the way that this deal has been formulated with through the six-party talks where you've got players including the US, Russia, China, South Korea and Japan, there's a chance, it feels, that North Korea could have sort of too much to lose if it tried to pull the plug again. The Herald Tribune leads on the story today, and it looks at the reaction in the US. On the one hand, you've got hawks like John Bolton saying it's a charade and the US should have held out for more. But there are people who are saying that, look, you know, this is a success in some senses for the Bush administration, which really needs a diplomatic success, what with all of the problems in the Middle East.
Now, tell us about this terrible tragedy, the murder of a two-year-old.
Yes, this is Casey Lei Mullen, who was found dead by her mother on Sunday. The police said last night that she died from compression of the neck. She was from Gipton in Leeds. Detectives have arrested a 21-year-old local man on suspicion of murder and sexual assault, and it is understood that the man is her uncle, Michael Mullen, the Guardian reports.
Now, it's the Brit Awards tonight, of course, and there's a lot of attention on the tabloids and in the other papers as well, actually, on Robbie Williams. What's all this about?
Yes, the photograph of Robbie Williams in cheeky chappy mode with a flat cap and a cigarette behind his ear is on the front of all of the tabloids. He checked into a rehab clinic in the US on his 33rd birthday yesterday to receive treatment for an addiction to prescription drugs. He has, of course, been to rehab before, first in 1995 after leaving Take That, and then again in 2004, which is around the period when he became one of the UK's most successful solo artists.
Now, it's February the 14th day. Thanks so much for the chocolates, Mark. You know, you really shouldn't have bothered. But not such a great day for Cleopatra, not that she's around to hear any of it, but what are they saying about her?
I love this intro in The Sun. Queen Cleopatra, considered one of history's babes, was really a minger, experts have found. A coin has turned up, a Roman coin in Newcastle-upon-Tyne, which depicts a kind of shrewish Cleopatra and in Mark Antony with bulging eyes and a bull neck. And all the papers are having some fun with this, saying that these Valentine's Day dream couple were probably a little bit more ugly than thought.
And so she's not as good-looking as Elizabeth Taylor and as good as that woman who played her in Carry On Cleo.
That's right.
Many thanks, Mark. And don't forget to subscribe to The Wrap, that's our daily email service, by going to guardian.co.uk/wrap. The United Nations published a report back in 2005 into the oil for food sanctions regime. The author of the report, Paul Volcker, claimed that British companies paid kickbacks to Saddam Hussein's regime. Now the Serious Fraud Office is investigating these allegations. I asked The Guardian's David Lee to remind us how it was that the Oil for Food programme allowed Saddam and his cronies to amass about $1.8 billion.
Well, at the time, Saddam was under sanctions and he was only allowed to sell oil if the proceeds were used for humanitarian purposes, i.e. for food and for medicines. That was the idea. But what he did was he demanded kickbacks from everybody in return for the contracts, both to sell the oil and contracts for to import the food and medicines. And they handed over the bribes, and Saddam and the Saddam regime put them in their pockets.
And tell us about the investigation by Paul Volcker.
A couple of years ago, the UN produced a report by Paul Volcker, who is an American former chairman of the Federal Reserve, which listed companies all over the world which it said had been paying kickbacks to Saddam. Their big target was actually French and Russian politicians, but they also listed a number of UK companies in this long report, and they produced detailed evidence from banking records. Of course, they'd taken over the Saddam ministry, so they got access to all the files, so they just rooted through all the files and they found all this rather damning information.
And tell us about this new investigation by the Serious Fraud Office.
When the Volcker report came out, copies were sent round by the US government all over the world to different countries saying, what are you going to do about it? The British sat on this for about a year, and now, remarkably, they've been handed £22 million by the Treasury to mount a very large investigation into the drug companies, the construction companies, the oil traders in Britain who were doing this. It's a bit of a coincidence that they've given them the money to do this right after the SFO investigation into alleged corruption by BAE, the arms company in Saudi Arabia, was killed off by the Prime Minister on grounds of national security, allegedly. So Britain had got a very bad name across the world as a result of this for doing nothing about corruption. I think it's politically welcome to be able to show that they are doing something, at least, about some sort of alleged corruption.
Which firms are being investigated?
The big drug companies are GlaxoSmithKline, AstraZeneca and Eli Lilly. They all got big contracts to supply medicines to Iraq under the Oil for Food programme. They're also investigating a bridge builder, maybe in Johnson, who got a contract for Bailey Bridges in Iraq to help communications. And a number of oil traders, among them Taurus Petroleum, run by an American, Ben Polner, who had an office here in Knightsbridge, and there's one or two other oil traders as well.
What are the firms that are being investigated saying about this?
Well, they all deny, in detail, at length, that they did anything wrong. And indeed, in fairness, Volcker says just because he names companies in the report who were involved in illicit kickbacks to Saddam doesn't mean the companies are actually to blame. It might have been their agents who did it without their knowledge. It might have been secondary companies, front companies who were involved in the chain of transactions. So what the SFO needs to investigate is whether the big British companies knew what was going on.
Tell us about the investigation into the MP George Galloway.
Ah, well, George Galloway has been a colourful figure for many years, and the accusations that Galloway was a sort of bagman for Saddam Hussein have been floating around for years now. Galloway always rejects them very indignantly. The facts of it are, Galloway ran a campaign called the Mariam Appeal, campaigning to lift sanctions against Iraq. He got donations for his campaign from a Jordanian businessman, and Volcker says the businessman got oil allocations from Saddam, he paid kickbacks to Saddam, and he gave some of the money to Galloway's appeal, and indeed put some of the money, it's alleged, into Galloway's then-wife's bank account. And this money was then used to campaign against sanctions. That wasn't supposed to be what the oil sales were for. They were supposed to be for humanitarian purposes, not for propaganda for Saddam. But the SFO says they don't want to investigate Galloway. They are in charge of corruption investigations. They say there isn't the evidence to pursue Galloway on charges of corruption. They've handed the file over to Scotland Yard and suggested that the Yard investigate Galloway for suspected sanctions busting, and the Yard hasn't yet decided what to do about that.
Peter Roberts, an accounts manager from Shropshire, has started a petition on the Number 10 website urging the government to scrap its road pricing proposals. Anyone can start a petition there, but this one's got 2 million signatures after getting loads of coverage and support in the Daily Mail. I asked The Guardian's political columnist Michael White what the government's plans for road pricing are.
Well, strictly speaking, they don't have any, and that's part of the frustration which even some supporters of road pricing say. Even the AA is not against it in principle, or the RAC Foundation. They just say, we don't know enough. It goes without saying that the Daily Mail knows a great deal, because it knows a great deal about everything, whether it's right or wrong. So this morning, they may be right about this, I'm not sure they are, but they may be. They tell their readers that documents sent by the government to 10 or a dozen councils who are going to do pilot schemes in the summer, bids in by July, they reveal quite a lot of detail of current government thinking.
This petition on the Number 10 website, what does that say?
It just says that there are a million people who don't want road pricing, but probably 999,910 of them don't know anything about it. They just think it's another scam to take their money. The road lobby, a great Middle England favourite, is full of self-pitying whinging, as we all know. I speak as a motorist. Motorists do pretty well out of the taxpayer one way or another, considering all the pollution and other inconveniences they cause. So they can see an opportunity here. Number 10 created this web platform, petitions, to engage in dialogue with the public, and they said, right, dialogue you're going to get, sunshine. So assisted by the usual suspects in the newspapers, Middle England newspapers, they just piled on the votes. That's excellent, that's fine, and ministers, using the magic of email, will reply to all of them, and they've got all their email addresses, because that's how it works. They'll send them all along, and no doubt informative explanation of what they're trying to do to stop us being gridlocked and global warmed to death.
This petition, though, it does seem to have caught the government off guard.
Well, they certainly money piled on. It's the biggest they've had so far, and I think I say somewhere in the paper this morning in The Guardian that the next biggest is 50,000 names against, it's either to bring back hunting or it's against ID cards. But anyway, this is the big success for the Daily Beast so far, and, you know, obviously piling on road taxes, motorists don't like it, and a lot of motorists, unlike city dwellers, depend on their cars. So I'm not criticizing motorists out of hand. People who live in rural areas where I grew up, they need a car, so I sympathize with them. But a lot of us in cities don't. Yeah, ministers were caught a bit off guard, you're quite right, but they'll be fighting back. And that's what dialogue and democracy and e-democracy is all about. It's about exchanges of information.
Some of the other petitions on the website, I mean, there's one to adopt Gold by Spandau Ballet as the new national anthem, and another to get Tony Blair to stand on his head and juggle ice cream. Do you think number 10 might be regretting allowing people to do this?
They're all vetted. I mean, some they don't allow on. I mean, as with petitions that you and I sign in the street, and as with Commons petitions, they're known as early day motions, which MPs sign sometimes when they shouldn't. Lots of them are daft. Congratulates Falkirk FC on its latest stirring victory in the Scottish League, that sort of nonsense. Or they're inaccurate. And that's part of democracy too. So I guess, I don't know the answer to this, but I'm guessing that number 10 let the daft ones on about Spandau Ballet, if that's daft, and no disrespect to Spandau Ballet, they let them on to make the site more fun to read.
Now, John Henley's in his luxury apartment on the Chiswick Acton borders, of course, with the Guardian Diary. John, the Diary's got news of a new competition.
That's right, yes, we launched a competition yesterday, John. I think we'll be applauding the early entries in this latest exciting event, which the question obviously was to answer the poser that we set. What on earth can Sainsbury's mean by the term adult cereals, which a few alert readers have notified us has started appearing on that fine supermarket chain's shelves. We've had various suggestions ranging from Porn Flakes to Vice Krispies or even lines of Cocoa Pops, doing very well so far. Keep those coming. I think this morning's diary will also be awarding the local news headline of the week to BBC Wales for Man Gets Breakfast Tattooed on Head. A cracker there from BBC Wales. And we'll be lamenting the fact, I think, also that we missed the Forklift Truck Association's Awards for Excellence Ceremony 2007, particularly since the event this year was cleverly dubbed Awards 007. And thus provided, it says here in this exceptional press release, tremendous Bond-themed entertainment. The FLTA, anyway, it says here, had promised thrills and spills, and the ceremony didn't disappoint, with explosions, stunts, and the association's chairman and vice chairman repelling a spectacular attack by a backflipping squad of ninja intruders. What's more, there was show-stopping cabaret by the Shirley Bassey impersonator Amanda, and among the top winners of this exceptional event were Hubtex, which collected the award for ergonomics for its twin-masted EZK20 long load picking platform, and the Crown's TSP 6000 turret order, which beat no fewer than six other contenders to win the Innovation Award, and particularly impressed voters, we hear, with superb performance in very narrow aisles. Sounds like a night to remember, and no mistake. And finally, our quote of the month will be going, we think, to the British Airways spokesman, who said of the row over that fine airline's new rule about charging if more than one bag goes into the hold, we are dealing with this on a case-by-case basis.
You see what they've done there. Many thanks, John. And don't forget to send John your details, or if you know Shirley Bassey impersonator Amanda, get in touch by going to diary@guardian.co.uk. The launch pad for young talent in Britain's rag trade is, of course, London Fashion Week. It's now upon us, and I asked our deputy fashion editor, Hadley Freeman, about this week's highlights.
Well, actually, for once, it's quite exciting this year. Normally, British fashion editors have to kind of work up a bit of enthusiasm, try to convince the masses that it's all great, when, in fact, most of the big-name designers like Stella McCartney and Alexander McQueen have fled town to richer shores. But this year, we have quite a few new and exciting names who genuinely are quite interesting to watch. There are people like Christopher Kane, who's extremely young, who's already been taken on by Versace, who had a very successful show last season. Similarly, Mario Schwab is another one who's garnered a lot of attention. Also, the main one, probably, probably is Mark by Marc Jacobs, which is Marc Jacobs' younger line, which is showing at the end of the week. And for once, he's showing in London instead of New York, mainly to mark the opening of his new shop, which is just coming.
Can we expect to see lots of skinny models on the catwalk this week?
Well, they're always going to be skinny models. And, you know, I guess to be fair to modern designers, models have long been skinny. The debate about it, though, I think has become completely out of proportion or just really misguided, to be honest. Absolutely, fashion industry needs to broaden its definition of what beauty is. It needs to be more than 8 stone and over 18 years old. But I do think that this constant banging on that models cause anorexia is extremely insulting to women on all levels. The idea that women are so sort of childlike that they need to be sheltered from models because if they see Kate Moss's hip bones, they're not going to eat lunch for 10 years is so insulting. And also the idea that eating disorders are caused by looking at models as though eating disorders are about vanity is, again, extremely insulting and diminishes the problem and is essentially saying that you become an alcoholic from watching too many beer adverts. It's not true. There is a problem, though. There is obviously a connection between this veneration of skinniness and eating disorders in that once you have an eating disorder, you feel like everybody else is confirming your own phobias, your beliefs, because you read magazines. They're all about how you should be thinner, how the best things to eat are only fruit. You know, if you're over a size 10, then you should lose weight and cellulite. It's embarrassing. Here's a big yellow arrow pointing at Jerry Halls. Obviously, this is all a problem. It condones eating disorders and it makes recovery much more difficult. And the fashion industry does have a part to play in that. But to say that it causes it is insulting to women who suffer from eating disorders and to those who don't.
But even if it doesn't cause it, has the fashion industry taken on board that there is public concern about the prevalence of skinny models?
They have definitely taken it on concern. I mean, you have spokespeople from the Milan and Madrid Fashion Weeks saying that it is a problem, and Diane von Furstenberg, who gave an interview in The Guardian just 2 weeks ago, also saying that it is a problem. And designers have made noises saying that if a model is looking unhealthy, then they won't hire her. It is a completely vicious circle, though, at this point. But to be honest, if you look at the models who get the most coverage, the sort of younger models whose names might not be familiar to all the listeners out there, but they will have seen their faces in every single magazine, people like Lily Cole, Lily Donaldson, Gemma Ward, the ones who are in every single show, they are relatively not that thin. The ones who you see as worryingly thin, the ones covered with sort of down on their arms to try to keep themselves warm, the really, really upsetting ones, you only see like in one show at most. I mean, to be honest, to have a really skinny model doesn't make any clothes look better, no matter what designers say. It needs to have a vague shape underneath the dress. And also the criticism that they're reaping from it now is too great.
Edith Piaf with Je ne regrette rien. No, me neither, Edith. La Môme, a new biopic of Edith Piaf, opens in French cinemas today. In Britain and the US, it will be called La Vie en Rose, after one of Piaf's other big hits. In France, the film's triggered a wave of nostalgia for its biggest musical export. Here's Angélique Chrysaphis, who's in The Guardian's Paris office.
Well, Edith Piaf is basically the universal symbol of melodramatic tragedy, the most appalling circumstances in her life which really make people feel so sorry for her. And then they hear this piercing voice on stage, this tiny, tiny figure who was the size of a 10-year-old in this trademark black dress, and people just melt. Now, you wouldn't believe the details of her life, which people have just been pouring over in France for the last few weeks. She's been on the front pages for days. She's on the front pages again today. She was basically born to a circus contortionist who was her father. Her mother was a nougat seller who sang on street corners. She grew up in a brothel in Normandy, which her grandmother ran. She went blind as a child in this brothel. She ended up back on the street singing for her father, living in the gutter sometimes, begging for money. Aged about 16, she had a baby with a delivery boy who she'd fallen in love with. The baby died when it was 2. All this happened before she was even discovered. Then by the time she was discovered by a cabaret owner, who's played by Gérard Depardieu in the film, he then died later. She was suspected of his murder and later cleared of it after police investigations. So all of this was raging while she was becoming well known. And then even after she was a real famous singer on the New York stage, Marcel Cerdan, one of her lovers, who was of course married, who was the great love of her life, died in a plane crash on his way to see her. She then finds this out an hour before she goes on stage, and this is actually portrayed very touchingly in the film. And then it basically broke her heart. There was this amazing detail of her life where she actually came back to Paris after he died and couldn't bear it, was so upset. She ended up singing again on street corners. Of course, she was one of the most famous singers in the world at this stage. And people in Paris were walking past saying, who's that sad old bag trying to look like Edith Piaf? And it was actually her.
Well, I mean, it's an incredible tale. What's taken them so long to put it onto the screen?
Well, it's very, very unlike a French filmmaker to produce this Hollywood-style biopic. It's told in flashbacks, and Variety, the America, sort of the American film Bible, said it was a real show must go on gumption, which is very un-French. They're not like the States, which loves doing these Johnny Cash and Ray Charles biopics. But I think they decided that this story was just too much. It just had to be told.
And do we know whether the story has been told well?
The critics loved it. I mean, actually, this morning, one of the French papers was saying, hang on a minute, there's not enough about her young lovers. But frankly, if they'd done a film about every single one of her lovers, I mean, the film would have lasted about 10 hours. The critics are really pleased with it. I mean, Variety thought it was great, and they thought that it's going to appeal to a young audience in America. Because don't forget, she's one of the biggest musical exports France has ever known. She's huge in Japan. She's massive in America. But it's usually over 45-year-olds that buy her stuff. But I think now, really, the Americans are thinking that the kind of punk generation, the young kids at the moment, the rap kids, are going to be buying Piaf and singing along to L'Avion Rose.
Edith Piaf there with Angélique Chrysaphis in Paris. Today's show was produced by Phil Maynard and Ben Green. I'm John Dennis. Thanks very much.
Guardian Unlimited.